Today, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, The Property Imperative, weekly to 21st September 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for joining me for my latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In this week's digest, we look at the Fed's plumbing problem, which central banks are cutting rates, and the latest on the trade talks. Plus, locally, the Australian economic data continues to point south, and the OECD is forecasting local growth down to 1.7%, which is a world away from the RBA's projections. And as usual, we'll start with the global scene, but if you want to go straight to the Australian section, then the time is shown below. But before I get into the detail, I could not help but draw parallels between the central bank's approach to dealing with monetary policy and The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which is a tale by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe called Der Zauberjüngling, which has been used by Disney, among others, and of course inspired the orchestral piece by Paul Dekar. It starts, "Gone for once the old magician, with his countenance forbidding. I'm now master, I'm tactician, all his ghosts must do my bidding, know his incantation, spell and gestures too. By my mind's creation, wonders shall I do." And the apprentice uses spells to get a broom to bring water from the river, but does not know enough to stop the place filling with water, and things get out of hand when he chops at the broom, so creating more and more. Woe, it is so, both the broken parts betoken one infernal servant's doubling. Woe, it is so, now do help me, powers eternal. Eventually, the magician comes back and puts things right. And that's how I see central banks, not as a magician, but as an apprentice, trying to use monetary tricks to save the banks, while in fact things are spinning further and further out of control. In so doing, the collateral damage to households across the world continues to rise, and the pace of chaos continues to increase, but with no end, because there is no magician to fix it up. The OECD this week, in their latest interim economic outlook, said the global economy has become increasingly fragile and uncertain, with growth slowing and downside risks continuing to mount. Economic prospects are weakening for both advanced and emerging economies, and global growth could get stuck at persistently low levels without firm policy actions from governments, according to the outlook. Escalating trade conflicts are taking an increasing toll on confidence and investment, adding to policy uncertainty, aggravating risks in financial markets and endangering already weak growth prospects worldwide. The OECD projects that the global economy will grow by 2.9% in 2019 and 3% in 2020, and that's the weakest annual growth rate since the financial crisis, with downside risks continuing to mount. The outlook covers all G20 economies and includes downward revisions to projections from the previous economic outlook in May 2019 for almost all countries, particularly those most exposed to the decline in global trade and investment that has set in this year. The outlook identifies the trade conflicts as the principal factor undermining confidence, growth, and job creation across the world economy, and underlines that continuation of trade restrictions and political uncertainty could bring additional adverse effects. While solid consumer demand has supported service sector output to date, they say persistent weakness in manufacturing sectors and continuing trade tensions could weaken employment growth, household income, and spending.
We now project growth will not even reach 3% this year, and will stay as weak next year. 18 months ago, we projected growth would be 4%. The outlook is weakening for both advanced and emerging economies. The trade conflict between the US and China is entrenching high levels of uncertainty. It is feeding a collapse in trade growth, creating a slump in manufacturing and depressing investment. These problems risk becoming structural. With high uncertainty being the new normal, low growth could become persistent, which would undermine people's jobs, living standards, and aspirations for years to come. Another risk is that huge levels of private debt have been building up and are adding to financial market tensions and oil prices. But more urgently, if the trade conflict worsens, supply chains would be disrupted, and that would hit confidence, growth, and jobs. The escalation in trade-distorting restrictions must stop. Businesses need a more predictable environment in which to thrive and create jobs. Governments need to take advantage of very low interest rates to invest in infrastructure. They need to invest in the future.
And substantial uncertainty persists about the timing and nature of the withdrawal of the United Kingdom from the European Union, particularly as concerns a possible no-deal exit, which could push the UK into recession in 2020 and lead to sectoral disruptions in Europe. Other risks, including the overall slowdown in the Chinese economy and significant financial market vulnerabilities from the tensions between slowing growth, high debt, and deteriorating credit quality, are also weighing on future growth. And the Fed, which cut rates this week by just 25 basis points, continued its efforts to unblock the financial system's plumbing by resurrecting their repo operations. The New York Fed has been conducting repo operations since Tuesday, when in the morning they offered up to $75 billion in cash for collateral at an interest rate that is within the Fed's target range. The allowed collateral are treasury securities, agency securities, and mortgage-backed securities guaranteed by the government-sponsored enterprises. These are overnight interest-bearing loans that unwind the next morning, with the Fed getting its $75 billion back in cash and the dealers getting their collateral back. As these operations were undertaken every day for the past 4 days, it's essentially the same $75 billion that gets recycled every day. The daily amounts are not additive, and these operations have nothing to do with QE. But as Wall Street puts it, the Fed's plan A of manipulating the federal funds rate into its target range, now between 1.75% and 2%, has miserably failed. So it switched to Plan B to control short-term interest rates. But this Plan B was Plan A that the Fed had used routinely to control short-term interest rates in the era before the financial crisis. So, back to the future. In September 2008, when the US financial system was threatening to freeze up, the Fed developed new tools on the spot, including bailout emergency loans to banks, industrial companies and market players under a variety of programs, and it shifted to ZIRP and QE. But it stopped the repo operations because they weren't needed anymore. But now the Fed says after October 10, 2019, the desk will conduct operations as necessary to help maintain the federal funds rate in the target range, the amounts and time of which have not yet been determined. And meantime, on Monday, they'll be at it again, up to $75 billion. What's happening, it seems, is that some financial institutions with liquidity available are not willing to trade with others in the overnight markets who have liquidity issues. And we suspect because trust in the financial system is again being questioned. And this is a horrible reminder of what happened in 2007 and is a warning to central banks globally. I suspect we're nearing the end of these experiments, but there is no wizard to restore calm, so expect more chaos ahead. Meantime, the news on trade talks between mid-level officials from the US and China is mixed as they prepare the ground for higher-level negotiations next month. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross commented on Thursday that it's more complicated than just buying a few more soybeans. In fact, Wall Street dropped on Friday on a report that a Chinese agricultural delegation decided not to visit farms in Nebraska and Montana and instead headed home. The worry was that cancellations like that were a signal the trade talks between the US and China weren't going well. And President Donald Trump said during the day that it would take more than agricultural purchases to settle the trade dispute, but there was no official explanation for the departures. In addition, the market was seeing volatility from a quadruple witching hour. That's a rare simultaneous settlement of futures and options of single stocks and stock indices. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.59% to 26,935. The S&P 500 lost 0.5% to 2,992, and the Nasdaq Composite dropped 0.8% to 8,117. Losses in the consumer services, technology, industrial sectors led shares lower, and the Dow is up 2.6% over the month, the S&P 500 up 5.39%, and the Nasdaq up 1.58% over the month. The volatility index, which measures the implied volatility of S&P 500 options, was up 9.04% to 15.32, but still down 8% over the month. Interest rates moved lower, even as two Federal Reserve officials argued over whether interest rates should be cut more. Boston Fed President Eric Rosengren is worried about inflating hard assets like real estate, and James Bullard of the St. Louis Fed is more worried about economic slowdown. The 10-year Treasury yield fell to 1.722% from Thursday's 1.774% and is down 9.4% over the month. The 3-month ended at 1.910, down 3.87% over the month. So the inversion, signalling a potential recession, grinds on. Crude oil had been much higher for much of the day but fell back at the close, although it ended the week up more than 6%. After the attacks on the Saudi plants, crude oil for delivery in November rose 0.38% to $58.41. Gold futures and the dollar moved higher, with gold futures for December delivery up 1.19% to $1,524 and was up just 1% over the past month. And the euro-US dollar was down 0.21% to 1.1017 and is down 0.56% over the past month. The US dollar index was up 0.19% to 98.51. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates at a quarter point rate, compounded by a spike in overnight US repo rates this week, which cut into demand for dollars. But we're seeing brewing central bank divergence as other major central banks, including the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and the Swiss National Bank, all left rates unchanged this week, which disappointed some dollar bulls. Other central banks are not in easing mode, as the Fed has been this week, and hopes of a breakthrough in trade talks between the United States and China is also dampening some of the safe haven appeal of the dollar. Sterling was the biggest gainer. European Commissioner President Jean-Claude Juncker said he thought Brussels could reach agreement with Britain on its departure from the European Union, but many think hopes are running ahead of reality. The UK isn't likely to present any legally binding proposals to break the deadlock until after the Conservative Party conference at the end of September. And the UK Supreme Court is expected to rule next week on the lawfulness of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's decision to suspend Parliament, a move that makes it harder for lawmakers to stop a no-deal Brexit happening by default. Sterling ended at 1.2479, down 0.43% on Friday, though it's still 1.78% higher over the month. The FTSE fell 0.16% to 7,344, and the financial sector index fell 0.26% to 739.3. In Germany, as part of its major overhaul plans, Deutsche Bank has auctioned portfolios of equity derivatives after dividing the same into three groups: European, Asian, and US books, according to Bloomberg. This auction is the first among many more to be completed. It basically involves flow equity derivatives. The second auction is likely to involve exotic derivatives, the sale of which is expected to be quite complex. European assets were acquired by Barclays PLC, while Goldman Sachs placed the winning bid for Asian equity assets, and Morgan Stanley purchased the US trades. So Deutsche Bank is making progress in exiting equities trading businesses with a view to addressing rising costs on a falling bottom line. A major part of the assets held previously in the stock trading division is now placed in a capital release unit, which will ensure their smooth winding down, though Deutsche Bank's restructuring efforts, like cost-saving measures, look encouraging. It is really difficult to determine how much the bank will gain, considering the lingering headwinds. Shares of Deutsche Bank ended at 7.364, down 0.91% on the day, but is up more than 17% over the past month. The German 10-year bond ended at minus 0.522%, down 0.96%, but is still up 17.98% over the week, and the Stoxx 600 was up 0.3% to 392.96, while the iShares Russell 2000 fell 0.26% to 155.43 and is up 3.55% over the month. Bitcoin ended at 10,136 and is down 2.12% over the week in volatile trading. Fitch Ratings said this week that banks in the Asia-Pacific region are increasingly exposed to property-related risks in a new report. The Australian and New Zealand banking sector have the greatest exposure to property market stress, while banks in Sri Lanka, Mongolia and Vietnam have the least protection from loss-absorbing buffers. They believe that regulatory oversight and macroprudential policies should contain the direct effect of a residential property downturn on banks, especially in developed markets where loss-absorbing buffers tend to be higher. However, accommodative monetary and economic policies could aggravate leverage. Rising household debt increases risks for banks as borrowers' debt servicing capacity becomes more sensitive to economic factors, and a high reliance on property to collateralize loans exposes banks to a property market downturn. Regulators in most of the region's developed markets have introduced macroprudential measures to stem property sector risks and to strengthen banking sector resilience to potential property stress, and they believe that policymakers will remain focused on measures that support stability and prevent the risks of overheating, despite recent macroprudential loosening in Australia, New Zealand, and Taiwan to support their economies. They expect Hong Kong, Singapore, and South Korea to maintain the tightening bias in their policy settings. And in passing, note the New Zealand GDP was just 0.5% in the last quarter, according to Statistics New Zealand. Between the June quarter of 2018 and the latest June quarter, GDP rose 2.1%, which was the slowest rate since December 2013, but is still way ahead of many other countries. New Zealand's population growth has been among the fastest in the world at 1.6%, owing to the nation's high immigration program. Thus, New Zealand's growth figures are being heavily inflated, and per capita growth is soft, much like Australia. In other words, this is a population-based form of quantitative easing. And we see signs of weaker household consumption and mining, manufacturing, construction, all in reverse. Real GDP per capita continues to ease, growing by just 0.2% over the quarter and just 0.8% over the year, the lowest annual per capita growth since 2011. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. Now turning to the Australian market, the local economic news was not that flash. The OECD is forecasting growth of 1.7% this year and slightly more next, but with more downside risk still present. The government finances reported a marginal deficit to June 2019, thanks to stronger than expected tax revenues due to higher employment and higher iron ore prices, mainly thanks to the Vale episode. On the downside, costs were contained with less spending than expected on the NDIS and other social programs to the tune of $6 billion, plus a mysterious $5 billion dividend from the RBA and other public corporations to help make up the numbers. This is clearly a manipulated result and sets up the government to make a surplus next year, but at what cost? Overall, net general government debt in June 2019 was $374 billion, which is 19.2% of GDP, some $12.5 billion higher than forecast in the April 2019 budget. And remember, GDP was 1.4%, not 3% as forecast, and wages growth was 2.2% compared with the expected 2.7%. So starving the disabled and children of promised cash added the most of all. Australia's trend unemployment rate increased in August 2019 to 5.3%, from the revised July 2019 figure, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. The trend participation rate increased further to 66.2%, while employment continued to grow above the 20-year annual average. But the true story is that we're not creating sufficient jobs for the growing population, and many of the jobs are part-time ones. Most economists think unemployment will continue to rise, with all the broader social implications that follow. And we discussed this economic news in our post, The Latest Economic Ins and Outs. One point to note is youth unemployment, which rose to a record high of 18.4% in August, whereas underutilisation rose to a near record high of 30.2%. So much potential going to waste. And more broadly, if employment growth slows to a crawl, thanks to the construction slowdown, weak household spending and slowing NDIS growth, unemployment could easily reach 6%. We ran our live event on Tuesday, which was well attended, and we discussed our scenarios with updated data. We still believe there is a potential path to higher home prices over the next couple of years if the RBA is right and unemployment stays lower, but the odds are still on more price pressure and the economy continues to deteriorate. And you can watch a replay of our live show with questions and also the live chat. The RBA minutes signalled potential rate cuts ahead, and Westpac was quick to reaffirm October and February cuts on the expectation of higher unemployment and deteriorating global conditions. They say, we think the RBA would see the move to 0.5% as the low point in the cycle, after which unconventional policies would be required. A prudent wait for that last move until early next year seems the most likely option. Against this bad news, auction clearance rates last week on low volumes were strong again, with CoreLogic saying that the weighted average held above 70% and has done so now for five consecutive weeks, which is substantially higher than what we were seeing over the same period last year, when only 50% of homes were selling at auction. Volumes, however, are tracking lower compared to the corresponding weeks last year. Too right. 1,983 a year ago, compared with 1,633 this time, and with 953 cleared auctions to boot. Also, we note the supply of new listings remains weaker than many expected, and our leading survey suggests many who had considered selling have chosen to wait because of the weaker confidence among households and the lack of price rises in many market sectors. And you can watch our latest discussion with Chris Bates on the dynamics of the diverse Sydney market. The home price index was up again in some places, but the trends do vary considerably. So if we turn to the CoreLogic index to the 19th of September 2019, in Sydney, prices over the last week rose 0.49%. Over the quarter, they've risen 3%. Annually, they've fallen 5.5%. And from peak, they're down 12.4%. In Melbourne, they rose 0.5% over the last week. They rose 3.03% over the quarter. They've fallen 4.6% over the last year and are down 8.4% from peak. In Brisbane, they rose 0.7% over the quarter. They've risen 0.29%. Annually, they've fallen down 2%. And from peak, they're down 2.1%. In Adelaide, they fell 0.03% over the last week. They fell 0.16% over the last quarter. They've fallen 1.2% over the last year, and they're down 1.6% from peak. And in Perth, they're down 0.16% over the last week. They've fallen 1.97% over the last quarter. They're down 8.9% for the last year, and they're now down 21.1% from peak. And over the five major centres, they rose 0.34% over the last week. They're up 1.9% over the quarter. They're down 5% over the last year. And from peak, they're down 9.1% across the major centres. And once again, I need to remind you that these are averages and, of course, individual price movements both across locations and by types of property have varied considerably. And we know that in some cases, prices have moved up indeed, but in other places, they're definitely still falling. Now, we can also look at the annual movements based on the CoreLogic series. And we can see that in Sydney, the trend is up, as in Melbourne. Whereas in Brisbane, it's sort of sideways. And in Adelaide, prices are continuing to fall. And they're also continuing to fall in Perth. But nevertheless, the five-city index continues to rise because, of course, of the large representation of the Sydney and Melbourne prices. And it's worth noting that not all locations in Sydney are behaving the same way. Most of the rises appear to be at the top end of the market and close into the major city centres, particularly houses, whereas units and houses further out on the urban fringe, particularly land and packages and new constructions, are continuing to fall. So again, need to be very careful with these averages. And the ABS Prices Index series to the end of June is so late that is hardly more than a historical artefact, given the rate cuts, APRA changes and other events. Since June, the kitchen sink has been thrown to try to force prices higher, though lead indicators are weakening again now. The total value of Australia's 10.3 million residential dwellings fell by $17.6 billion to $6.6 trillion in the June quarter. And they said that through the year, residential property prices fell 7.4% in the June quarter. Prices fell 9.6% in Sydney, 9.3% in Melbourne. Hobart rose 2%, and that was the only capital city to record positive growth through the year. As we covered in our post, The Cash Ban Breakthrough, The Game's Afoot, Michael Sukkar introduced the bill into Parliament this week.
Government business, notice number 4, currency restrictions on the use of cash bill 2019.
I call the Assistant Treasurer.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. I present the currency restrictions on the use of cash bill 2019 and the explanatory memorandum.
The clerk.
First reading, a bill for an act to restrict the use of cash in transactions and for related purposes.
And I call the Assistant Treasurer.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. I move that this bill be now read a second time. This bill establishes the cash payment limit and introduces offences for entities that make or accept cash payments of $10,000 or more from the 1st of January 2020. The Black Economy Task Force final report found that large cash payments can be anonymous and untraceable, allowing businesses to underreport their income and to offer consumers discounts for transactions that reflect the business's avoided obligations. This practice has a profound negative impact on businesses that do the right thing. The vast majority of businesses that diligently pay their tax and meet their other obligations are not able to offer the same unfairly discounted price for their goods or services. The cash payment limit sends a strong signal to the community that the government will protect the rights of honest businesses and their families from unfair competition from those who want to avoid their obligations. The cash payment limit not only targets those avoiding tax, but more importantly and more crucially, it helps to fight organised crime syndicates. We know that large amounts of cash is essential to the businesses of modern criminal gangs. These gangs launder the cash from the proceeds of manufacturing and selling drugs and other serious crimes through the legitimate economy. The cash limit will make it harder for them to do so. The government is committed to providing our intelligence agencies with the tools and the laws that enable them to disrupt these activities. This is not to say that consumers and businesses don't have legitimate reasons to conduct cash transactions, and the government recognises that cash remains an important part of the economy and a legitimate means of payment for individuals and businesses. The cash payment limit will only apply to businesses and individuals that make or accept payments that involve $10,000 or more in cash, as I've noted. The majority of businesses and individuals' daily interactions involving cash, according to the Black Economy final report, are unlikely to exceed the cash payment limit. We are living in a time where a large majority of businesses now transact through electronic payment methods, which reduces their costs associated with the storage, transport, loss, and monitoring of cash. Importantly, the cash payment limit does not apply to private transactions, including real property transactions, for example, the sale of a private car to another person. I should say, Mr. Speaker, excluding real property transactions. All Australians will continue to be able to deposit and withdraw cash in excess of $10,000 into and from their accounts, and to store more than $10,000 of their money outside a bank if they choose to do so. Black economy activity is not simply a matter of underreporting income or tax. It's a criminal matter, It can involve criminal activity to hide income through the exploitation of people, processes and systems. And therefore, the government is sending a strong message to the community and to criminal syndicates, more importantly, that using cash to avoid obligations and engage in criminal activity is a serious matter that requires a sufficient level of deterrence. Contravening the cash payment limit carries with it a criminal offence provision, as noted earlier. The penalties provide a balance between monetary penalties to deter the use of cash transactions to avoid tax obligations and jails for individuals and businesses who are involved in organised crime. I would like to take this opportunity, Mr. Speaker, to acknowledge the work of Michael Andrew AO, whose passion and dedication to combat the black economy was instrumental in the introduction of this legislation. Unfortunately, Michael recently passed away, and I wish to pass on my condolences to his family. Yeah. The government shares Michael's commitment to tackling the black economy, tackling crime, and to ensure a fairer environment for all Australians. Full details of the measure are contained in the explanatory memorandum.
And just while the Assistant Treasurer is there, I'd very much like to associate myself with the remarks he made with respect to the late Michael Andrew, who performed a very, very important role and with dedication for a long period of time. And for those of us from Melbourne who knew him well, I'm glad that the Assistant Minister took the time to make those remarks. The debate must now be adjourned. The member for Rankin.
Thank you, Speaker. I move the debate be adjourned.
Question is that the resumption of the debate be made an order of the day for the next sitting. All those of that opinion say aye. Contrary, no. The ayes have it. And I call the clerk.
It was promptly sent off to a Senate inquiry with the support of Labor, the Greens, One Nation and Centre Alliance. Good on them. And we have 2 months to make a submission. The Economics Legislation Committee will report by the 7th of February 2020 and submissions close on the 15th of November 2019. So time to get in some quality content to ensure the bill does not pass. And Zero Hedge pulled no punches. Australia has become perhaps the most aggressive country in Western culture to hunt down its own citizens for money. They follow school children and then investigate how the parents are paying for the school. The Australian Tax Office has applied for access to everything to hunt for money. They want access to phone calls, emails, posts and SMS text messages. And Australians could face 2 years' jail sentences and fines of up to $25,200 under proposed laws that limit the use of cash to $10,000, a move some groups argue would create an Orwellian state by giving authorities greater power over people's finances. The government's slogan, cash is for criminals. This was hidden in the 2018 Australian government budget and claimed it would save $5.3 billion by banning cash payments of $10,000 or more. The then Australian Treasurer, Scott Morrison, said that it was a crackdown on the black economy. And this bill creates an offence which did not previously exist and leaves the implementation and exemptions from its provisions to rules to be made by the Treasurer. And we know this is more to do with preparing the path for negative interest rates, because allowing cash transactions will negate the impact of such policies, as the IMF have explained in a number of recent papers. And we're going to share some more information soon on some additional themes for potential submissions. And so, to the markets. So looking at the Australian market, the ASX 100 closed up 0.18% on Friday at 5,581. The Financial Services Index was up 0.28% to 6,495. And the Local Volatility Index was up 3.78% to 1,297. ANZ ended at 27.83. The CBA ended at 82.18. NAB was at 29.32 and Westpac was at 29.57. The Bank of Queensland ended at 9.72, up 0.21%. Bendigo was up 0.61% to 11.50. Suncorp closed at 13.68. Macquarie closed at 131.77. And AMP was at 1.77. 87. Genworth was up 2.9% to 355. McGrath was down 2.27% at 21.5 cents. And Yellow Brick Road was down 1.25% at 7.9 cents. AFG was up 3.56% to 233. Mortgage Choice was down 0.45% to 1.11. And the Aussie US dollar closed at 67.69 cents, which is down 0.29%, having peaked higher in the week as the US dollar temporarily was weaker. The euro Aussie dollar was up 0.16% to 1.6277. And the gold Aussie cross was up 1.6% to 2,240. While the Bitcoin Aussie cross fell 0.51% to 14,838. Finally, a chart courtesy of the CEC. The total value of derivatives held by Australian banks has spiked to a massive $48.7 trillion. In comparison, they have $1.8 trillion in mortgage loans. This highlights again the risk in the system and why bank deposits could be at risk if these derivatives go wrong. So the sorcerer's apprentice is in full fling in Australia too. Banks are getting more and more bloated and the risks are rising ever faster. The question now is only when does the music stop and what will the consequences be? And remember, there is no magician. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.